Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to Cast Jarvis. My name is Christian Corley, and joining me this week, pretty much as ever, is James McLean. How are you doing, James?
I'm all right. Yourself?
I'm okay. We have some slight internet issues this week, so it is an audio-only podcast, unfortunately, so you don't get to look at us emoting and gesticulating and seeing the prototypes of the high-scoring videos that James keeps pulling on YouTube. When I share these things, it just keeps happening. So we've talked a lot about stuff over the past few weeks relating to Doctor Who and the other show that's coming along, the War Between the Land and the Sea. I think I got it right this time because I've accidentally called it something else recently and no one knew what I was talking about. Obviously, there are matters arising from these things because we've had a lot of feedback for these, and I wanted to pick a few of them out and talk about them a little further. So, but before we do that, there's a question I need to ask James, and that is, will you be watching The War Between the Land and the Sea?
Yeah, I think I will be. Will you?
I was initially thinking I will probably skip it, but I think I may watch it, yes. I think it will happen, although I'm not sure if I'll be able to watch it as it's aired. It'll probably be like the next day or a couple of days later or something, because I think it coincides something that we're doing. But yeah, I'll be watching it so we can talk about it on the podcast.
Cool. That's a good idea.
I thought so, yes.
We're still going to have this lag, aren't we? This internet lag all the way through. There's going to be these tiny pauses.
Quite possibly, yeah. But, you know, we'll just... The listener knows what's going on now, so, as you just told them.
Yes. Yeah, that actually was a pause because I didn't have anything to say rather than a pause due to internet lag.
Okay. So, there was one other thing that I wanted to say. The thing about Tom Baker getting an MBE and dressing like Doctor Who again. That was like the nicest internet content I'd seen for days when I saw that.
I think I saw it. Was it images with him next to the, or in the police box?
Yeah, with the police box, yeah. And those Daleks and things going on. And then some photos later on. So, yeah.
It's weird as well, I suppose. I mean, we see this a lot now, which we didn't so much when we were younger, where we get that sort of replication of sort of the past in that way. I mean, I'm thinking like when you get in the 80s, maybe William Shatner doing something about Star Trek and spoofing it, for instance, and it would just be, you know, a bad version of the outfit he'd have been wearing. It wouldn't look... Yeah. But, you know, now you have almost like a replica of the kind of prop that he'd have been using as a police box, the clothes as well. And yet you've got this weird thing of seeing this very dignified older man compared to the sort of very, you know, zany, energetic Tom Baker of old. And your brain's kind of reconciling the two. So it's a weird thing to see.
It is a bit, yeah. The Shatner thing, though, I mean, did that start with... I'm going off on a complete tangent here. That wonderful moment in Airplane 2. Is that where Shatner started kind of doing that sort of thing?
Spoofing himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it probably is. And he did it again in Free Enterprise in the 90s, where he sort of plays a sort of boring version of William Shatner.
Right.
Have you seen that?
I haven't seen that, no. Right, okay.
It's based on sort of, semi-autobiographical so far. Certainly the experiences, the two creators were budding filmmakers in Hollywood, and they have a story where one of them, who I think is, I can't remember if it's the one who's played by what's the name of the actor from Will and Grace, anyway he sort of has an imaginary Captain Kirk who guides him through school as a sort of like a totem to sort of give him courage. And then when he's trying to make a film, he meets William Shatner, and William Shatner agrees to be part of his film, and William Shatner only wants to be part of it as long as he can do a full-length monologue. I think it's of Macbeth or Hamlet, I can't remember which, is And of course, all his ideas are terrible, and they're having to reconcile the, as you say, the sort of legacy, their memory as fans of Captain Kirk and William Shatner, well, meeting William Shatner. Of course, Shatner plays himself up for this. But yeah, it was
Yes.
unusual. I would love actually to do a podcast. I don't think we have done on Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, because I think that is such a landmark film in terms of thinking about where the sort of, not the industry per se, but where film story writing started to acknowledge its own canon as being legitimate and something that can continue rather than it being set in one space. So, you know, Star Trek was part of the world of syndication, where every episode had to sort of kind of stand alone because they could then be shown in any order.
Any
But
order, yep.
you get to Star Trek too, and that's kind of the first time where they sort of saying, actually, these characters can get old, and William Shatner's Captain Kirk in Star Trek II is turning 50. And the tale goes that Nick Meyer, the director and writer, had to really convince Shatner that this was a good idea, rather than to continually trying to de-age them as best they could and pretend that there hadn't been much time that had passed, but to actually sort of interrogate that whole thing of, you know, these people getting older, not just for the audience, but for, you know, as characters. I don't think really in these sort of like franchise shows, certainly sci-fi, that had ever been done outside of soaps, really. It's certainly in films anyway, certainly in these big film sci-fi things, to actually start really acknowledging age. I suppose going back to Doctor Who, you could say Doctor Who was doing it first. You can look at Tom Baker era, actually, specifically. I can think of like Pyramids of Mars, where he talks about, you know, being middle-aged. You get Logopolis, which really is about, there is a sense of age and continuity there and self-reflection. So, you know, Doctor Who is probably doing this more, but for films, Star Trek too, you know, it's kind of that first one where, you know, heroes are allowed to get old, and we can accept that. And I think that's it's a really interesting turning point. It's a fascinating film. I still think it's one of the greatest science fiction films ever made, regardless of whether you like Star Trek or not. It's just a beautifully written film. So we should probably do a
Yeah, it's a good movie.
podcast on that. Yeah.
Yeah,
See, there's
okay,
no worries
agreed.
about gaps in our conversation if I don't let you speak.
That's the
Oh,
secret.
yeah. It's the
So
secret
let's
of our long-term partnership.
it is. Yeah. I always let other people talk. Yeah. Anyway, so let's just dive in. Now there's as I said, we've for a while we've had videos going on YouTube. And our conversation a couple of weeks ago about Shu Gatwa's legacy is the one that's attracted the most conversation, perhaps inevitably, I suppose. I want to start with, we'll start with YouTube, and then we'll go to the conversation on our Patreon, because that's there's a different level of conversation going on here, which may be, you know, it's different fans, different. At different places and different attitudes to conversation, I suppose, is the secret here. So we talked about what Shu Gatwa's legacy would be with Doctor, and I think generally, the feeling that maybe immediately it's not as strong as some of his immediate predecessors, but later on there'll be a reappraisal and people will appreciate it a bit more. So we've got comments like "Shooty who? He sucked. Last few have sucked." These are on YouTube. There is an insightful one here. Some people have box sets on their shelves which they will never watch, and he will be on the covers of some magazines and books that will never be read. Which is maybe that's probably the most intelligent comment on the YouTube side of things, and I can see the point. I mean, that's maybe true for some people. You've got another one that says 100% didn't deliver. The fact his daughter was constantly crying, emotional wreck. Some of the off-screen comments that he made as well.
But wasn't that the same com that was the same sort of things that she was said about Tennant at the back end of his era? People were saying he was too emotional, people were calling
Yeah.
him the emo doctor. And it's
Yes,
interesting
exactly.
how his legacy now is seen as like sort of almost like the pinnacle of New Who.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say it was Matt Smith, but whatever.
And some people do as well, yeah, sorry.
So
Dorcas
that's the YouTube
Freckleston.
side of thing. And well, yeah. and pick one. No, and we so we appreciate these comments, and it's nice to be able to generate these conversations. And so do please keep your comments coming. Now, Aaron West, one of our patron supporters, had a lot to say on this. Singing goblins, talking babies, and bogey monsters were too much to take in quick succession, and most were out by episode three. Aaron works with students, so a bit like yourself. So he's had some conversations about these sorts of things. So just jump there. They're genuinely excited when Shooter was cast, but none of them still watched the show. They lost interest around Empire of Death. And a lot of this is very much the sort of thing that we talk about, and it's like coming from a different person. So students with no problem with a gay doctor but expected storylines to be grounded, dark, and serious. Fans like myself in the 25-35 bracket are equally been crying out for another empty child. I mean, there's probably a mix of things going on there, but because everyone has different favorites, etc. But there is Netflix gave them easy access to Stranger Things as children, and they've grown up on that. So this is pretty much reflecting the things that we've been saying over quite some time now.
Yeah, it's like
And
you can see the
yeah, go on.
logic of what Davis was trying to do, but whether the actually landed for any of the demographics that is another point entirely.
Yeah, the there was I think I observed, well, I mean, we observed this with the 60th anniversary, and again, I seem to recall observing it with the Robot Revolution. It's very heavy, and heavier than with Davies' earlier tenure, comic book feel to a lot of the stuff, which I think maybe another comment Aaron says is, I think quirky, silly Doctor Who has lost the room. And Davies, a lot of Davies' stuff, certainly stuff that Davies writes, does fall into quirky and silly at times, whether it's an
Yeah,
entire
always
story,
has
or there's
done.
like a key scene or whatever. Yeah. And I, this, but this is the thing. It's, I was talking to someone about this. Who was it? A member of my family, I think, about the, or it might even been, it was me talking to the listener last week when I was hosting solo. Is this, I have this kind of notion that Doctor Who is, or maybe it's you as well, isn't really the thing that the fans expect the BBC to support Doctor in a particular way, and it doesn't get that. And is that, yeah, it was that conversation we had about that, the Whoniverse, and it being like a missed opportunity, etc., etc. And I increasingly it feels like the BBC doesn't really know what Doctor Who is. And this is something that we've always had, but it feels like post Moffat, say, it's really increasingly a fit, they're a TV show that they've got that does a thing, but they don't really understand what it is. And if they ask, the opportunity to just like expand that, which was right there, it was in their face, it's perfect opportunity to spread the wings. They do a spin-off, and it takes like 2 years to get to television, and like missed opportunities. And I think this maybe comes back into this whole notion that they have this show, and this goes back to the 80s, maybe like late 70s onwards. They have a show, a popular show, with a with a loyal audience who will, many of whom will watch even if they're hating it, and they just don't seem to know what to do. There's no kind of leadership of the show beyond the person who's in charge of the show. And I mean, are they given expectations? Of course they are, because they have to hit particular audience, figures and things, and there's probably a merchandise element to it, etc., etc., etc. But it feels, I don't know, it feels like it's lacked direction. And I'm not just talking with Davies as well. There's an element to the Chibnall Doctor, maybe late Moffat as well, of that.
I think, yeah, and I think some of it comes from an uncertainty of the terrain. If we sort of say that that uncertainty has been felt since like some of Capaldi, so you're kind of talking 2013, 2014, where you're starting to see a move towards streaming. I think, yeah, the show and its audiences as well are not quite sure what they want out of it or how it should be within this new Garden of Delights. And I think that's very much part of it. And I think as well, with like Davis has always said that Disney had no production influence over how they ran the show. There's no doubt that if you partner with a certain brand, you're going to be factoring in that audience or how you perceive that audience or perhaps what they are going to be anticipating out of that deal as well. So there's going to be a little bit of that in there too. So I think in some ways it might be almost like it's there's just too many directions for shows to know really what they want to do. And also, something we never really talk about, which is really odd, is that while you might sort of say, you might not say that Doctor Who gets as many viewers these days as it did in like 1979, at the same time, you think now we are now 60 years in, which means you've got 60 years worth of different views of Doctor Who to take into account. That's a larger span of generations than the show has ever had. So now you're competing with not just the sort of assumptions of Gen X in 2005 and boomers and very young millennials. You're now looking at millennials who grew up with Doctor Who, but Gen Z who grew up with Doctor Who all have their perceptions of their memories of it when they grew up to interrogate this new one. So you've got multiple generations now, more generations in a way. I mean, yes, you could argue, yes, obviously there are some generations which have passed since, say it was on in the 60s. But in terms of interrogating where Doctor Who is now and what, say, Shuti Gatwell or Russell T Davies is doing, that's a lot of generations of thinking of what Doctor Who is or what Doctor Who should be now that they're having to acknowledge and work for. And I think that is probably also one of the problems. It's you can sort of say, well, why did Davis stick with almost like the Rose format? That first series with Shooty was almost like a retread, a lot of it, of the Rose story. And I imagine it's still in a sense, it's because he's like, well, I want to appeal to the peoples whose memory of Doctor Who is that format. That's their nostalgia. But as soon as you do that, you've got older people like myself or yourself going, but we've seen that. Why aren't we doing something different? That's not nostalgic to me. In fact, I found it a bit frustrating back then. Why are we going back there? So I think there's so many things that that show is trying to have to tap into and it can't. And on top of that, as we said previously, it's so clear that the show is struggling against its own production with Shooty not being available for a lot of season one, for series two. You're sort of getting a sense of sort of the back end, and Shooty is obviously clearly going, and that's got to have rewrites. There's a lot of things going on there which are just not, it's not a comfortable space. It's not a smooth space.
You
So,
know,
yeah.
I had this this kind of thought the other day when I was thinking about that whole sort of thing. I think it was after we last chatted. You know, there's this period, and I think it still happens, but there was this period, particularly sort of like 10, 15 years ago, where rock bands would record, and not just rock bands, other acts as well, but they would record an album, but they wouldn't be together. So you'd have some of the group laying down tracks in, Los Angeles, and then the vocalist recording his bit in Spain or whatever. And everything's timed perfectly. And it sounds like a competent recording, a good song perhaps, but then it misses that element of the people, the personnel actually being together to record something together and collaborate properly. And I think there's an element of that, certainly to the first series with Shooty, that he's not there quite a lot. There's scenes rewritten, other people doing stuff, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, there's no collaboration there. There's no feeling of authenticity because people that you can see are there, they're not really there. They're only there for that moment. They haven't worked on it together with the other people in the same way that you would have seen in other shows on at the time and previously on the same show. And
Yeah, no, absolutely.
it's a strange thing. I remember when I first read about that whole idea of bands recording separately, and I guess it's probably because they don't get along well, or unfortunately, maybe they get along too well and cause havoc with, you know, bad habits and local, you know, ne'er-do-wells supplying them with narcotics or whatever, and they want to keep that at arm's length, and maybe they just come out of rehab or whatever. But this is a guy who's an actor, so I'm really frustrated by the whole idea that they cast someone who wasn't available, really.
Yeah.
It does seem absolutely mind-blowing to me.
But there are so many things in this season, and I should say with most of the seasons of Doctor Who, I don't subscribe to what a lot of those YouTube comments were saying. I enjoyed a lot of what I watched, but it still felt rough around the edges. I found the small things that they were putting in there, which I think you could accept, or I don't know, maybe also it's a reiteration thing. You're reiterating or so many things you've done in the show before in slightly different ways. So, for instance, the Rani storyline, which went for 2 seasons, where we didn't know who this character was and she was sitting in the background, it felt like a sort of not just a not like a tease thread, almost like a mystery box thing. It almost felt like a latent thing from another series. When it sort of you saw her in the first early episodes, or when she recognizes the police box, I think in the first shooty episode, the first proper shooty episode, or the Christmas show, you don't feel like I didn't feel like, oh, who is this person? I felt, oh, great. So we've got this sort of vague trapping that's going to meander on through, and ultimately is not going to give an answer which anyone is ever going to be happy with. And it's like, why deploy it? And it should pop up now and again, and it just felt. I don't know. Everything just felt a little cluttered and a little messy. And I think part of that is also as soon as you start seeing the episode orders get tighter too, that also causes a problem that you're having the same things you've seen done before, but with less space, even less space to breathe than it had before. And I think that becomes a problem too. So I think the problem is there are loads of ways that you can slap down this series as we're seeing in YouTube comments. And again, that's a new thing too, to some degree. I mean, not for new who, but to be able to vocalize your disdain and then that disdain kind of spread and become almost like a norm. I was watching, I got Paramount Plus for a little bit, and I was
Oh, me
watching
too.
the Section 31 spin-off, the Star Trek spin-off, which was came out earlier this year and was absolutely hammered by audiences and critics. To a
Is
point
this the
where,
animated one?
no, it
All right.
was, it's basically a spin-off which is set not within the usual Starfleety space, but with a set of essentially rogues of on a black ops.
Okay.
And it's around them. And it was absolutely hammered by, as I say, not just the audiences, but also critics. And I think on IMDb, it's got like a 3.8 rating. And so when I went in to watch that, which I wasn't really going to watch because I'd heard how terrible it was, I didn't really want to watch it because that had become the truth. And yet I watched it and I was like, well, actually, this isn't that bad. It's not like the most mind-blowing thing that I've ever seen, but it's not where I had started to form that truth is where it is. And I think that's part of the problem we have now is that we can't help it, but the voices we hear do affect what we think before we've even seen something. Or when we've seen something, it can sometimes impact on what we think, or sometimes what we think we should be thinking, when the
There's
truth is somewhere in the middle.
yes, invariably. There is, I think, just looking wider at other Doctor Who videos, not our own, whether they're official ones or other podcasts. There's a very angry Irishman on YouTube who podcasts about Doctor Who quite regularly. And comments, I'm thinking maybe from a sort of like mimetic angle, going back to we called this a few times recently, the old days of the news groups and the whole McCoy versus Pertwee thing, etc. And I think we talked about it in the last podcast we did together. It's kind of like the comments kind of reflecting people's feelings and also informing how we the legacy, I suppose. And I think people are a lot more comfortable commenting on YouTube and saying what they want to say about things. And YouTube obviously has its kind of comment ranking system, so you can see which comments are appreciated more than others. And there is a general feeling like a push toward, well, pushing in the right way. There's a general kind of attitude that's wholly, I would say that, like, the majority is dissatisfied with the last couple of series of Doctor Who. Let's put it that way. But I wanted to just go back to what you said about the kind of like the tightening and the re The Mrs. Flood character existing possibly from a previous plot thread or whatever, because we had that also with the flood with the Flux, didn't we? With the fellow who played Doc Cotton in Line of Duty, whose name escapes me at the moment.
Yes.
His character
Yes, I
appeared to
forgot
have a
about
very
that. Yes.
significant part, but it turned out he just didn't have any real role whatsoever. So there's that very promising kind of like
Yeah.
existence in there, and then he just kind of went nowhere. And the same with
Yeah,
the
no.
Captain Jack replacement character as well. So I mean, obviously these things happen, and there was a lot going on when Flux was recorded. We had the COVID thing and the lockdowns, etc. And other
But I
shows
think
didn't really
also,
suffer in the same way. There are shows that did suffer in the same way, but there are plenty of shows and movies that managed to get by this.
I wonder, like with the Mrs. Flood thing, whether some of that and why that was there was because there was an awareness that you're not going to have your main character there a lot. So you're looking to fortify your show with mysteries and pulls, which perhaps don't even necessarily have a properly formulated outcome. Because I never really felt when you discover who Flood is, that it really felt a satisfying resolution to what you'd already seen. The pathway of Mrs. Flood didn't really feel like anything to do with the Rani. Didn't really feel like it had any massive, it had a convoluted logic to why she was everywhere. But it didn't feel like it was a necessary pathway to that outcome. So that outcome felt a bit left field from that pathway. So again, it felt uncomfortably messy. And it sounds like there's a lot with the way Davis worked with this is inspirational or I wouldn't say impulsive, but taking advantage of opportunity. So for instance, getting Susan back feels like an opportunity rather than something that was perhaps something which was in his head at the very beginning. I could be wrong. I think also going back to the things like YouTube, we've also got to always remember that the people who you never hear on YouTube are the people who are content because they've got no reason to post. They've got no reason to actually go and look for these things to like or dislike. So they're not going to be the ardent fans who feel a need to actually put their opinion either way, whether they loved it or not. Because let's face it, when there is a show story which goes down well, there's a lot of positive things you'll see on a YouTube thing. Quite often, it's almost sometimes with some factions of fans, I think it's I don't know whether it's conscious or not, but I think it's almost like a gambit as an overall strategy that if you can prove that one episode is really good and you really liked it, it gives you a better battleground to say the rest of the show is rubbish and this is what it should be like. And you see that happen quite a lot. And there's almost like a sort of, yeah, I've been saying how terrible this is, but this is a really good example. So therefore, the rest, it almost gives a credibility to that. I'm not just slamming everything, this is what it should be. And I always find that a little frustrating. So I think it's a hard space to actually work out how things have gone down well. And I suppose part of my issue with it is, like I said, I feel I'm a fairly intelligent person. I feel I'm someone who's followed the show. I don't feel like I'm someone who will say I liked something for the sake of it. And yet a lot of his episodes I did enjoy. I found them quite refreshing in their own weird way. So on that basis, I can't sort of subscribe to say this was as terrible as I'm told I am by people in the comment section, because I legitimately see some value in there. I again, I wouldn't say everything was perfect. And as we're talking about now, I think it was a messy two-season run in a lot of ways, far more messy than what we saw in season one or season two of Davis's first run. Which had equally had its share of issues and uncertainties. But this goes back to what you were saying before. There was a sort of sense maybe that Davis wasn't quite, or the production wasn't quite as alone, or wasn't quite as adrift in such a saturated and confusing market as it was back then. I mean, yeah, no one knew whether Doctor Who would work back in 2005, but it just had to stand out against four other channels. That were running. No, it just had to show stand out against four other programs. That's really the answer here. In 2005, it had to shine against four other programs running at the same time. Now it's got to run against a saturation of channels and programs running at any time. And people are like, why is this not as good as it was? Probably because, yeah, One of the axioms of media is, of the media industries, is that, and we've talked about this before, is it's a risky business. There's a scholar called David Hesmondhalsch, who I like the way he's always put it, has always said, you know, the problem with the market, and others have said it's not just him, but he said it well. The problem with the market is that it's front loaded with costs, and yet the back end is actually fairly cheap. You know, it's expensive to build a car, but it's not expensive to distribute a DVD or to put something on television as it is to actually make it. So all your costs are up front a long time before you're going to air, whether it's a film or a television show, especially for films. But you don't know what the market's going to be like at that point, whether it's going to have turned. You don't know what the tastes are. You can't even guarantee your own fan base is going to like it. So the shows and films that do well are people who are just kind of good, I guess, at just figuring out what's going to work within that period and nailing it. But it's a really hard job. And now we're in a situation where it's even harder, far harder to work out what people want, especially when there's multiple people, multiple voices shouting. And you've got to sometimes go with your gut. And I think Davis's approach is to say, this is what I would want, and that is what I'm going to make, with a certain, not just that, but I think he goes a lot with him as a consumer. So the sort of very sort of LGBT approach to it, pushing the social boundaries a bit. Those are things which I think interest him, so they go into the show. But it's a hard predictor, isn't it? And I kind of feel for the shooty era. It's a mess, but there was a lot of fresh stuff since, you know, and different to the Chibnall era. It'll be interesting to see whether the Chibnall era will now get a more of a golden era if people are so frustrated with the Davis era that it kind of bumps up what they didn't like before.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if that happened. I just wanted to go back to what you said, because you referred to Mrs. Flood of the Rani, and I felt that, I mean, I agree with what you said about that, but I also felt that there's something kind of very two-dimensional and placeholderish about that character, and also the two returning villains in the two series. As well. And that just feels, just again, missed opportunities, but it also feels like it's not doing a service to those characters. It's letting people down, because it's letting classic fans down because they're not delivering the same things. It makes them, the whole whatever's going on with Sutekh and the Time War, that's a thing, whether it's reset, whatever, I don't know. And if that was the explanation, but also it's also letting down new fans, because it's not giving them a proper opportunity to appreciate those characters either, because they're not really there for very long either. It all just feels a bit of a hodgepodge.
I mean, there's a nice moment in its Empires of Death, isn't it, where you get a little bit of Flood reacting to everyone being turned to dust, and her inability to do anything about that at that point. I think that's kind of what you needed more of. If you're going to do that, you need to make Flood someone far more integrated, rather than someone who kind of just appears occasionally in an episode in a sort of almost like essentially she's a bad wolf sign, you know. In 2005, an episode would end and you'd see Bad Wolf written somewhere. And she's kind of reduced to being, as you say, as flat as that. And it's just not satisfying. It's a funny, I'd love to have a frank conversation with Davis over this. I'd love to know whether he actually found it harder than he anticipated working back in the show, whether the actual shifts in the way that the world works and how the BBC works and how the market is actually made it far more difficult to him than perhaps he anticipated it would be. I mean, I think he did some brilliant things. I mean, I think if it's true, and because of Shooty's inavailability turning to Tennant, you know, that, I mean, that's a, you know, real left field way approaching, and that was great. That disrupted everything. It was fun. I kind of thought the bioregeneration was a fun shift. I know a lot of people hated it, but you've got to keep trying to do something new with this show. Otherwise, it will start to get stale. I think, again, bringing Susan in, and unfortunately that didn't pay off by the sounds of it due to the massive problems with Shooty leaving. You know, the Tales of the TARDIS, I think that was a great, you know, doing the coloured Doctor Who episodes. I think that was a great move. I know a lot of people don't like them because they do also, they don't just color, they interfere. And I do get that. I do appreciate that being a frustration. But in terms of looking at almost regenerating what the show can do, the roots are there, but they just don't flourish. And I think that's the sad thing. And I wonder, as you're going again back to what you were saying, is that a little bit because he's kind of left on his own? He's an island working with the BBC, working with Bad Wolf, working with Disney, and he just doesn't have the architecture to do what he wants to do. Because really, you kind of felt like there should have been like a continual growth in old Doctor Who's and the older ones being revamped to give them a legacy. You feel like there should have been more pushed into, the Tales of the TARDIS. Great idea, Is there anything to do more than that? There just is a sort of set, the sense of binding the two classic and the new ones together felt like a real project, which was only partially handled. And
There's
wrong choices of spin-offs as well, maybe. Well, we'll see. I mean, it might be a
well, we'll see
brilliant
about that.
story,
This
but it does, as we've said before, it does feel like an odd choice for Doctor Who.
Returning to the music allegory earlier, it's almost a difficult second album, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're stuck trying to reinvent yourself, but sort of bring back kind of what your legacy was all about. And you do feel the show struggling a lot in a way which again, look at Chibnall Era. I know people didn't like it, but it was a far, aside from the back end with COVID, it was a far smoother run in terms of what it was doing, which this era didn't really have. But at the same time, like I said, I hope that in the long term people look back and just look at like Shooty's Doctor and then say, oh, he cries a lot, and you think, look at him, look at this character, he is the first Doctor in so long which really feels like his own embodiment rather than being thrust scripted lines to remind us of Tom Baker. This feels like a, and that's the passion in the character as well. There's some real, really beautiful things happening there, which maybe is lost in the frustration, or of how of the outcomes of this series.
The chat continues on Patreon. If you're a member there, then check out the version of the podcast that goes out there early, ad-free, and with extra content. For everyone else, it's the end of the podcast. The War Between the Land and the Sea is going to be on TV on the 7th of December on BBC One and on iPlayer from 8:30. The Sea Devils edited edition will be on iPlayer all day and on BBC Four at 7 p.m. the same night. So you could
But
essentially put up. Oh, go on.
the weird thing is, yeah, because the original is on iPlayer already, so it's a funny
Ah,
thing,
yes.
isn't it?
Yeah. Be on twice.
Yeah.
So that's your Silurian and Sea Devil nights entertainments for you.
You never expected you'd want one of those, or that
No,
you'd ever get one of those.
indeed. Yes. Yeah, definitely that one. So obviously we welcome your comments. So we're very interested to hear a bit more from you. And if you've any thoughts about what we were talking about, particularly about the Rani and the Sutekh, I'm just going to call it the Sutekh and the Omega. and if you're looking forward to the Sea Devil thing or not, do let us know either in the comments of where you are experiencing this, or get in touch podcastderbys@gmail.com on the email or through the Patreon or any of the, just you know how to do it. We'll be back next time, but before I do that, if you're listening to this on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a review so we can extend our reach and find more listeners. Until next time, it's goodbye from us.